Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Welcome, everybody, to the Bay Area Book Festival, and thank you so much for coming out this morning. One thing I will say, it's easy to get across the bridge on a Sunday morning from San Francisco, so there was incentive. My name is Terry Gamble. I am a writer and a novelist, and I have been honored to be invited today to moderate this panel on historical fiction with these three wonderful writers. Let me introduce them now. Onto my left is Adrian Sharp, whose most recent book is the marvelous, magnificent Esme Wells. She is magnificent. Adrian is also a writer of a short story collection called White Swan, Black Swan, and another novel, The Sleeping Beauty, which I believe was shortlisted on a book list as one of the top best debut novels in that year, in 2005, right? Linda Spaulding, whose most recent novel is The Reckoning. It's a sequel to The Purchase. And Linda is also a longtime editor of Brick Magazine, a nonfiction writer, and a writer of other novels as well. And to our far left is Heather O'Neill, who's a novelist, a poet, an essayist, a screenwriter, and whose most recent book is The Heartbreak Hotel, but also was her earlier novel, I love her titles, The Lullabies for Little Criminals, won the Orange Prize in Canada. So anyway, I see this panel as mostly a discussion. We'll have time for questions at the end, and we have a hard stop between 11:15. I guess that's a soft stop. And the books will be available out on the patio, and I really recommend all three of these beautiful, beautiful novels. So historical fiction, I think I was asked to do this panel because I have a book coming out that's set in the 1820s on the Ohio River. And so I have some empathy for writing about a time that predates your own life and the challenges for the research and trying to cull out a story and find the similarities about people that existed before we did, and yet under circumstances that might be a bit foreign to us, particularly if they're set before electricity was invented. So I'd love to ask all three of you, not only about your research and what drew you to this particular time that in which you've set your novel, and please say a little bit about that time, but also how having a historic novel that's more about character and relationship has informed your understanding of the world that we're in today. Because we are accumulation of what went before, and yet here we are. And for whatever your feelings about our current circumstances, there are reasons how we got there. And I found that there were themes to tease out in all three of these books, that the one is the Depression, one is during slave times, and one is during leading up to the First World War and right after. So why don't we start with you, Adrian? How did you do your research? How did you decide on Los Angeles and Las Vegas, 1939 to 1952?
Mine was a bit of a personal story. My character, Esme Wells, is a bit of a mashup of my mother's story and my uncle's story. My mother was a daughter of these two very gorgeous, very reckless parents who decided when the racetracks were being built in the Los Angeles area that they wanted to be part of it. So my mother was turning six and school age and would be difficult to transport. They left her behind in an orphanage on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. They moved west. They had a second baby there, a son, who lived the life my mother wished she had lived, in that she wished she could have been with her parents. But the life my uncle lived was a very difficult one. He never went to school. He was dragged around the racetracks. He ate hot dogs, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And his life was ruined, whereas my mother ended up going to college on many scholarships and could have gone to medical school if she'd wanted to. My uncle ended up working as a janitor after he left the army, and he was just as brilliant and beautiful as my mother was. So I put those two characters together and had the little girl be the California child and imagined her being dragged around by her mom, the Busby Berkeley dancer, to the sound stages, and her dad all over the racetracks of Hollywood Park, Santa Anita, Del Mar. And then eventually the characters end up in just post-war, very nascent Las Vegas, where the girl I thought would be more interesting than a boy to have sort of navigate that landscape and look at the way women had to climb a certain scaffold of male power and find their own way. She ends up becoming her father's protector, or so she thinks, until she realizes unwittingly that she's betrayed him. So I guess my being drawn to that time was because that was sort of my mom's story.
Thank you. How about you, Linda?
Well, I think mine's also quite personal, although in a more distant way. I had ancestors in Virginia who were slave owners. And when I realized that as a child, I was quite stunned because I thought we were such liberal, good, fine people. And my father was a sort of civil rights attorney in Topeka, Kansas. And so that came as a big shock, and yet he seemed to sort of pass it off as not very big news. And there was that, and there was also the knowledge that I had come from a family who had arrived in Kansas in a covered wagon. And believe me, as a little girl in the 50s, that was romantic. Mm-hmm. I thought about it a lot. I thought about what that covered wagon looked like and smelled like and why they were in it and why they had come. And, you know, we had a special centennial celebration in Topeka, and we put on sunbonnets and fancy frilly blouses and so forth and long skirts, and I was in it. Boy, I was truly, truly, truly involved in that spectacle and in that imaginary life. And I always thought about it. I would be in the back seat of the car and think, what did it look like without electric lines? What was it like when all the Native Americans, of course I didn't call them that then, were living here? What did their houses look like? You know, I was just obsessed with it. I don't know why. And there was another part of the family saga that hit me very hard, and that was that when the family left Virginia in the covered wagon, they had a bear.
Oh, that's true.
They had a pet bear. Mm-hmm. And the pet bear's name was Cuff. This was all historically, you know, given to me as a sort of, you know, like the Bible, sort of this is what it was. And the long trek with the bear really confused me because I knew that I'd never heard about a bear later. I hadn't heard about a bear in Kansas, and I suspected that a bear in a wagon train, a whole train of wagons, would be a problem. I mean, I knew enough as a 10-year-old to figure that that would be an issue. And I used to say, what happened to Cuff? And, well, you know. So then I thought, they killed Cuff. I know they did. They killed Cuff. But no, they can't have killed Cuff. My family wouldn't do that. Anyway, so all these things sort of wrestled in my brain for about 400 years, which is how long ago it feels. And little tiny facts, like my father saying that when we left Virginia, we freed the slaves and gave each one a mule. Well, is that enough? You know? Mm-hmm. I mean, even a kid says, really? A mule? That's going to get you through? Mm-hmm. So all these things just confounded me for many, many, many years, and I began to look through the records, and I went to Virginia, and I looked in the courthouse, and I looked at census records, and how many slaves did we really have, and what happened to the great big house, and anyway, I put enough of it together that there were still a lot of delicious holes that I could fill in my own way, which is, I kind of think, what historical fiction is, because we do know that history is history. Mm-hmm. But we don't really know what anybody mm-hmm. thought mm-hmm. or who was mad or who was crazy or who was a drunk. Mm. Because those things don't get recorded. We're very careful not to record this. My mother used to do genealogies, and I'd say, yeah, but what were they like? Mm-hmm. Well, that didn't matter. It was only matter that could you be in the DAR or something, you know? And I thought that was really boring. So I always wanted to, even when I go to a cemetery, I want to know the story for everybody else. Stand in front of a grave for half an hour and try and figure out when the child died, how old was the mother, and, you know. So that's just my little quirk.
Uh-huh. So this book is worth reading just to find out what happened to Cuff the Bear. It's quite moving. Heather, Montreal and the Depression, Orphanage.
So I'll give my sort of personal take on it too. I feel with every novel, one sort of needs a personal connection to it. And so this novel, it kind of had its origin a long time ago for me. I was raised by my dad. He was a single dad. And he was born in 1927, and he was the youngest of nine boys. Mm. And his father died when he was three. So his mother was left alone with nine boys during the Great Depression. So naturally, they all turned to crime. And my dad was 11 years old at the time, and he used to work for these larger gangster organizations, and his job was to like climb through windows or deliver packages. And when he was 11, he spent a year in prison for breaking into a garment factory. And back then they didn't separate juvenile detention with the adults, so he was in with all the hardened criminals. And actually it turned out that the garment factory was owned by Leonard Cohen's father. Oh, so when I was growing up, I was never allowed to listen to Leonard Cohen music because my dad was like, the O'Neills and the Cohens don't mix.
For good reason.
Yeah, so then anyways, after the war, he decided to go on the straight and narrow and leave the criminal life behind. And it was the greatest regret of his life because he realized that his true calling had been in crime and it was the only thing he was really good at. So at night, he would tell me all these amazing stories about his criminal life, and they were like my bedtime stories. And he told them in this really rose-colored way so that I also thought, like, the criminal life was the best kind of life a person could hope for. And he'd tell all these beautiful tales about running across, like, rooftops and stuff. And he had dropped out of school when he was in grade three, so he really didn't know how to read and write. But then one of my uncles gave me a journal when I was about 9 years old for my birthday, and I discovered that I really liked writing, and I would just record, and I kept a diary of everything that happened during the day, and it kind of gave everything a sort of value and made everybody seem like characters. And then whenever I was finished the journal, my dad would burn it, because he was like, "This, all your uncles are going to go to jail when the cops get a hold of these diaries." So, he was really delighted that I knew how to read and write so well, so he would get me to record his thoughts also. So I would transcribe the letters for him, and they'd be like, "Dear Joe, listen, you stupid fuckhead, if you're not going to fucking get this fucking shit together," and I'd be like, "Dad, it's not syntactically possible to use fuck that many times in a sentence." And he would be like, "Heather, just write what I have to say." So anyways, when I was 22, I decided that I was going to write a gangster novel, because my dad and I would just watch all these gangster movies together. And so I wrote it, and there was about 35 different characters and 25 bloody murders. And then when I was done, it was 5 pages long. Then when my dad passed away, I was going through the old things, and I found this little novel that I had written and stapled together, and I found within all those strange characters, there was the character of Piero and Rose, who I was really interested in, and how they had got to be such sort of, like, Piero was this melancholic sort of genius gangster, and Rose was this sort of cross between a gangster's mall and Simone de Beauvoir. And so I decided to do their entire origin from the beginning. So I found them, they're both origin stories, and told their life. And now that I knew how to actually write a novel, that would be more than 5 pages.
That's interesting. And this novel reads like a fairy tale, and it has this harlequin-esque pacing and these
characters. I just want to know, Heather, did you cry when your father burned your little journals? Or did you just jump up and down with glee, or what was the...
No, I didn't really care, but now, of course, I sort of regret it archive-wise.
Yeah. You didn't care?
They'd be so... I mean, at the time, he was like, this is just a necessity. Like, diaries get used against you in court. And, I mean, this was just his valuable life advice, and he thought it was like a natural... He assumed it was like just a natural thing, like everybody ends up in court at one point. So he had to protect me against that.
Yeah. So was Perrault, was he sort of a combination? I can see elements of your father. I also know that you had a relationship early on with somebody who also had a problem with addiction, and I feel that comes out in the novel and sets the course of Perrault. Was that part of, were they all in that, or was that already left over from early childhood experience? You talk about meeting addicts in the park, and that you experience misfits with infinite forgiveness. I love that.
I mean, Perrault is, yeah, of course, the characters evolved so much from what I know as an adult, and the consequences of that life. I mean, as a child, it seemed so wonderful, but Perrault is, in a lot of ways, based on my partner, who, when I was younger, I met him in high school, and we were sort of high school sweethearts, and we... sort of decided to spend our entire lives together, and we actually had a baby really young, but he had a heroin addiction, and he overdosed. Mm-hmm. So actually, in all my male characters so far, there's certain traumas that just exist in your books, and even though you try not to have them there, they exist. So all my male protagonists, they all have heroin addictions.
Okay, thank you. And Linda, I'm wondering too, and you found your family were slaveholders, and in the book, they're descended from Quaker abolitionists. I don't know if that was also true in his family history. Mm-hmm. But like, what do you access when we think about slavery today, what did you have to personally access within you to really be able to describe the... how that institution really demoralizes slave and slaveholder alike. I thought you did such a good job in this character of John, who's a pastor, a Methodist pastor, and yet. Yeah.
Well, I think that was what interested me, because I'd written an earlier book about the Quaker who bought the first slave. And that was another thing that I'd learned as a child, is that we were Quakers, but then this had happened. And I knew enough about Quakerism, I was quite involved with it during high school years, that I just thought that was extraordinarily weird. And that what that must have done to him, the buyer of the slave, to his psyche, to his soul, to whatever you want to call it, his character, must have been incredibly warped and must have suffered in some way. I mean, let's think about PTSD. Something would have affected him, and I suspect affected all of the future generations. Mm-hmm. Some kind of, guilt, angst, misery. So, or who knows? One had to think about all that to a very deep degree, what all the repercussions might have been for a man like that, and who went on to buy other slaves, and why would he have done that? So that was part of the thing, and then it was just a consideration of my father's life, which was so dedicated to justice, and thinking, how much of all this stuff trickles down, and how much are we always reacting to the things that come before us, even if we don't know what they were or if we tend to discount them.
Yeah. It's like almost like epigenetics, you know, of how that expresses itself. You know, Adrian, I was thinking yesterday, I finished Esme about 2 days ago, and I wanted to call Child Protective Services, and anybody would. I mean, I feel this is the case also for Rose and Pierrot, you know, these are terribly abused children. And Esme, I think it's interesting that she is a synthesis of both your mother and your uncle, but here's this kid who's neglected, she's illiterate, she's filthy, she has, I think, critters living on her body, she smells, but she's absolutely beautiful, and she knows she's absolutely beautiful, and it's at a time where women's beauty was their currency. Maybe it still is, but anyway, we're working on that. I would love to know if you, in writing Esme, creating Esme, and letting this whole book be told through her point of view, if at any point you wanted to, like, help her. I know her father at one point very ineffectually does try to warn her about Nate Stein, this much older man she's going to take up with. But
I think Esme had sort of two goals in the book. And in the first part of the book that's set in 1939 in Los Angeles, she just wants her parents to be happy and to stay together. And she does whatever she can to engineer this. She knows that her mom's dream, like the dream of a lot of young women in LA at that time, was to be a movie star, and that the parents' marriage rested on the fact that the father was going to help her do this. He doesn't, of course. What he does do is get her a job dancing at one of the new clubs on the Sunset Strip that Mickey Cohen and Ben Siegel were opening up at that time. And she ends up in one of Ben Siegel's abortion parlors with terrible results. The pathos of Esme loving these parents, despite the fact that they were terrible to her, was a sort of the sad truth of my mom's life. I never met these grandparents that I'm writing about. My mom still speaks about them with a desire to be loved that I incorporated into Esme. Toward the end, even my mom would wonder, did her parents remember her, think about her? Would they leave her a note, leave her something in their wills? No, they did not. But that kind of desire for that parental love is what drives this book. Esme puts her high-heeled shoes on when she gets to Las Vegas and doesn't realize at first how much she's about to be exploited. She thinks Ben Siegel's like a second daddy who comes back to Vegas from LA and brings her perfume, lipstick, dresses, high-heeled shoes, and she feels like he's just helping her to grow up. He's murdered before he can ultimately probably take her as one of his mistresses. And after she does have her first sexual encounter with the fictional mobster I made, sort of based on a combo of a lot of men in Vegas at that time, that's when she finally realizes, and she has this vision of Ben Siegel standing outside her dark bedroom window, shaking his head at her, you know, what have you done? How has your life brought you to this man's bed? And she's going to make the best of the life that she can because she realizes she can't count on her father. He's a low-level operative in Las Vegas. She now has access to much higher levels. So she's going to protect herself and try to protect her father.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's such a challenge that you told this story through this one point of view, you know, as a child's point of view, because it's really an adult story about sort of the seedy underbelly of Los Angeles, Las Vegas, and I mean, you even have to stash your character in the back of a car to get her to go to a Bund Nazi rally in Los Angeles. I mean, it's like, that is the challenge of writing, is how do we tell this story, frame it, and tell it to it through a plausible point of view. So I think that you pulled it off, and it was not easy, I bet.
I went through a few incarnations. At first, it was from the mom's point of view, then the dad's, then the little boy, then the little boy grown up as a choreographer in Vegas making shows for his mom. But none of them exactly clicked until I just settled myself into my mom's childhood shoes. And it's a different take, I think, on those worlds to have a child see it as well.
Okay. And then Linda, on in The Reckoning, you use multiple points of view. And I think, but and yet every single character, we care about every single character.
Oh, good, I'm glad.
And, but I also think it was like sort of, there's a sense in that novel to me about like the forward motion, the getting in the wagon, you know, having to leave, you know, their financial basis for their farm, which is slavery, falls apart because of the abolitionist arriving. And it starts a series of what may be fortunate events, but for them was unfortunate events. It's a picaresque almost of, you know, one after the other. So as you're, like, can you talk a little bit about why you chose to tell this through multiple points of view and what the challenge was to be able to have, I think you pronounced it Bri or Brie?
Yeah, I say Bri.
And, okay, and Lavina.
I think that's what interests me about writing. I've always thought at sort of dinner parties, at sitting around a table with a bunch of people, how fabulous it would be if you really knew what they were thinking instead of just what they were saying. You know, because we're all blah, 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 but inside I'm thinking about, you know, did I feed my cat? Why did, on that Sunday 20 years ago, did my father slap me? Or whatever, you know? We're in millions of places at once. And I think I find that a requirement now in writing in order to have any fun. I've written a couple of novels in the first person, and it's very restrictive. I mean, it's fun because you can then explore all the ins and outs of your own brain, but you can't really get into anybody else's. And that's such a treat, you know, because we really can't do it, really, in real life. I mean, we don't have ESP, I don't think. So that's the real treat. That's the fun part. That's the, you know, the candy.
And it allowed for a bigger scope, I think, of the story.
Yeah, and then you can show that how entirely they are misunderstanding each other, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I was talking to my friend Liz, who's sitting over there this morning, about the tiny misunderstandings we have with our mates about, is he doing that just to annoy me, or is he doing that because he doesn't realize I'm annoyed? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's all that, you know, that we assume things that may not be at all the case. And that's what's fun about novels, in my mind.
And Heather, you take it even one step further. You have the point of view of inanimate objects sometimes. You'll just sort of toss something in. And I think that others have written this about your writing, but, you know, I'm so struck by your metaphors, your similes, your descriptive. And I know you've mentioned your hypographia, about which I'm very jealous that you have that ability, that urge to write, and it comes across on the page. There's an urgency that, that beats staccato, and these images that take your breath away. And there's a picture I saw of you with your daughter with a kind of a crazy wallpaper behind you, and there's so many wallpaper descriptions in your book and detailed clothing, and you are a screenwriter, and I think about you as a child sort of fixated on these details. So did you sometimes embody inanimate objects? I mean, how did you get into that point of view?
I've always done that with my writing. Usually in my novels, everything is alive. So even like the different buildings have different personalities. Like there'll be a cantankerous building that just insists on like the windows slamming down all the time just because it's a moody bastard of a building.
Love that.
But then, and it's like, it's like in one of my books, and the wallpaper is always an important character. And I have one book where the wallpaper, it actually changes because there's roses on it and it grows. And and I remember I have one scene in another book where the spoons inside the utensil drawer are really nervous and they're all trembling and they want to be held. So for me, everything, even like the shoes are alive and sometimes want to be worn and sometimes don't. And I guess it's the world. I mean, I think I started off writing as a poet where everything is, so everything that goes into my book is living and breathing and has a commentary on it, and often I'll have a lot of cats, and the cats are always like a Greek chorus, and whenever a cat passes by, like a cat will have some sort of commentary on what's just happened and be like, whoa, reader, are you paying attention to these idiots, and move on. So it's like there's no hierarchy in the novel, and that comes from me from writing a bit like Mavis Gallant once said, a writer is a child in disguise, and it's sort of a childlike vision of the world where they think that there are creatures living in the closet and under the bed. And for me as a writer, I'm like, well, maybe there are. Mm-hmm. Should we not take this seriously? Mm-hmm. And where they think, you know, a little plastic lion is their best friend. Mm-hmm. So in my novels, these things are all given sort of metaphorical and existential importance.
And that really works in this novel because the two protagonists are so childlike, even in adulthood. And their creativity is, their vision is so informed by just a child's view of the world with the clowns and the music. Mm-hmm. And I love that. And I also love that, without, you know, spoiler alert, but that there's sort of this tone of the happy childhood that never was, that you get redeemed at the end. And I found that really, really moving. You also said one time that you wrote a story about a cockroach that aspired to be a cricket. Is that a story? But you said this is a theme in all of your work.
Yeah, the first thing I ever got published was when I was in grade 5, and I wrote a story about a cockroach who's trying to pass himself off as a cricket in the world, because crickets just have better PR and are just don't have the negative connotations that a cockroach does, and it got published in the elementary school, like the citywide.
They sound so much better than cockroaches, too.
Yeah.
They sing.
And it's funny to go back to that because I realized, oh, my themes are still the same, actually.
I love those elementary school newspapers. I wrote about Berta the Beetle, an exoskeleto adventure. My mother kept it. So let's talk about sex. There's amazing, you are all amazing sex writers. In different, yes, you are, Linda.
I
you
avoided.
Are.
No, I avoided.
Yeah.
And no one had sex in the 19th century.
Well, Lavina doesn't know she's having sex.
That's true.
And that's, I thought, was really sexy. You know, it was interesting. I mean, I think that all of you as writers leave it up to various details to the imagining, and some details not to the imagining at all. I think that it's very difficult to write sex well and not have it just be sort of smut or porn or cheesy or bodice rippery. And so tell me about your sex writing.
And when I was a younger writer, I had a writing group, and one of my friends, and it said, I can always tell when your characters are going to have sex because they start to smell things. And that's something that I hadn't realized at all. The sex in my book is sort of exploiting the young girl. She's, you know, just barely 18, and this man is almost 50 and has already been through 3 wives and has children with these other wives. And with her, he seems to unleash something in her that allows her to feel that she can now do something like this on the stage. Lily St. Cyr was a very famous stripper in the 50s, and she came out to the El Rancho and did one of her burlesque shows, very modest by today's standards, but still she was arrested in LA for the similar performance. They were mostly women in the bedroom changing their clothes with the help of a maid, or slipping into something more comfortable behind a screen and then sliding into bed and throwing the robe off, so you never really saw anything. But I think this girl has so little stability in her life that her sexual power becomes a power for her that she wants to exhibit on the stage. And she realizes, I can take the stage from Lily St. Cyr, and I can be the midnight show at the Painted Desert Room, at the Desert Inn, and I can start to rake in some money from this, and then I can ask my protector for a cut of the tables. And she realizes this is my way to keep myself from becoming, at age 30, the waitress with support hose in the hotel coffee shop, because she can see the trajectory of women's lives in the Las Vegas casinos. But she ends up damaging herself, of course, from doing this. And her protector then starts to want to protect her from herself by taking this act away from her. And with that, he takes away some of her power. Mm-hmm. I started as a dancer, not a writer. And so the stage to me is always one of those very alive places. And you're naked on it, whether you're in a tutu or whether you're in a G-string, you are exposed there. And it's a very vibrant, kind of vibrating place when you're performing. And I wanted to capture the fact that she was very powerful in that place when she was on that stage. For her, sex became a means of power.
I don't know that sex was a means of power so much in The Reckoning, but there's a sexual awakening of sorts that struck me.
I think it's probably Levina's first experience of physical pleasure, mm-hmm. you know.
It's a medical.
It has a little bit to do with a lot of drinking of laudanum, which a lot of people did in those days, covered wagon or no. And a lot of people were giving it to their children. Mm-hmm. In great quantities, but I think she feels kind of that someone's interested in her and takes pleasure in her, and that she's never felt that before. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's probably a lot of women's experience the first time that happens, even now.
You know, it was really poignant in that book. Mm-hmm. And then Rose with her amazing sexual power and.
There is so much sex in my novel.
That's true. There is.
I'm actually trying to, as a writer, to stop writing so many sex scenes. Even with my editor is always like, you know, this sex scene is really, it's really great and it's powerful, but it really doesn't need to be 9 pages long. I'm like, oh, you're right. Well, I mean, for me, just as a writer, I never understood, like, for a while, I remember reading Tessa the D'Urbervilles, which was one of my favorite novels, and then it gets to the point where she has sex, and it's like such a pivotal moment, and like, how does she get seduced or raped, and then I turned the page, and it was like, we're gone to another scene, and I was like, Where is the sex? Like, why would you leave that out? So it never occurred to me that I should leave out sex scenes because they were just so part of the story. And I had read, actually, I grew up in this big building, and one of the tenants was a book hoarder. Like, he had books that went up to the ceiling and in the bathtub and in the stove. And he used to leave pornographic novels on the steps going up to my apartment, and I read everything, so I became really well-versed in Victorian pornography and Henry Miller and Anais Nin, and I kind of, so there's that, I had that background of research. and, well, one of the funny things about doing historical novels, too, is the idea of how you're going to describe the sex. So there was one part in this novel where Rose becomes involved in pornography, so I started researching 1930s pornography, and it's really not, like, if you watch 1930s pornography, you're not going to be turned on at all, because it's a lot of, like, tiptoeing around, people going, on peeping through peeping through doorknobs, and there was one I was watching where this woman is working at an office, and it's really hot, so she puts the fan on, and then her clothes start to blow off, and then her boss comes in, and his clothes start to blow off, and then a priest comes in, and his clothes start to blow off. So I was trying in those pornographic scenes to kind of mirror that staccato, kind of almost amusing way, because in every era we look at sex in a different way.
But your women don't get vanquished. They don't sort of not know what's happening or necessarily feel regret, as I remember.
No, and it's also, Rose, also one of the things I was doing with the sex in the novel was circumventing other modes. Like, one of the great traditions in the English novels, starting with like Samuel Richardson's Pamela, is having the male master of the house try to seduce the young maid who works there. So in this novel, where Rose is such an incredibly like powerful lunatic, she ends up being employed by this very powerful man, and she decides to seduce him. And he's always running around trying to avoid her, and he'll bump into her in the hall, and she'll be like holding a cup of milk. And she's like, if you give me a dollar, I'll put this on the ground and lap it up like a kitten. And he's like, you're just too crazy. And he's always trying to like avoid Rose as she goes around the house trying to seduce him. So it was like, I was circumventing those kind of old roles of like where the master is always trying to seduce, pretty much rape the young heroine of the novel. And this one, it's the heroine of the novel trying to seduce like the master of the house, where he's like, get away from me. So there's sex is used in so many different ways in the novel. There's lots of sex. But then of course, at the beginning, the most problematic sex scene in it is at the beginning, and it's probably the most controversial scene that I've ever written and has gotten all sorts of people upset. Because it's at the beginning, Piero, when he's a child, is sexually abused, and there was a question of, do I describe it implicitly or do I leave it within? Juno Diaz just wrote an essay called The Silence, and I think one of the things about childhood abuse is like we never discuss it.
Right.
And it's just you allude to it, and there is no vocabulary
and
for it.
And it's very rarely a woman to a little boy.
So
For me, it was because I'm also, when I was a child, because my dad just let me run around the streets all the time, so I was a survivor of sexual assault. So for me, it was like, you don't get to have the wonder of their world, of these survivors, if you don't witness their pain. So it's like the first 10 or 20 pages of the novel are horrific. But then it's like you only earn the beauty of their later art and who they become and their philosophy if you can go through their childhood with them.
Thank you. That really helps. Yeah. And I like the way that you ended up dealing with that and finding justice on that issue. I think that was... So speaking of sort of justice, I mean, I do think that the strength of Rose overshines that of Perrault ultimately, although he's so gifted. I think in Linda's book, we also, you know, the role of women is so much passive. It's so, they're so really at the mercy of these husbands whose whims, whether they'll, you know, join them on the wagon train, or, you know, he's having a relationship with a slave in the stable and thinks that she loves him. She doesn't love him. She basically tells him later on, just go away. Just go, stop. They're just so at the mercy of these men. And then Esme really epitomizes that. She has to decide what alliances to make that are going to really help for her survival. I detect a current theme in today's world. And I know you're not writing about today's world, and you're not necessarily making commentary on today's world, and yet here we are. So I wonder if your characters, if you can indulge me here and imagine what your character would be like if she. I'll take the women, the female characters, although there are strong male characters in all these books. But what would she say if it were today and she had the opportunity to say hashtag me too?
Well, I'd like to speak on behalf of my Levina, because when she is told the day before the wagon train is going to leave that her husband isn't going to accompany her, she says, I'm going.
Yeah.
That was pretty ballsy.
That's true.
And then as she makes that journey, she finds out really how tough and how resilient and how decisive she can be. And so that I think by the end, although he's rejoined her, he's left as a kind of, you know, ruined mm-hmm. human being, and she's onward and upward.
Yeah.
That's my feeling. Yeah. So I don't think mm-hmm. I left her where she started.
No, absolutely
okay.
not.
Okay, good. Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
My character at the end has to decide whether to stay in Las Vegas where her father has been murdered or whether to leave. And she's got nothing to leave with except a purse of diamond necklaces and rings that her protector has given her. And he's also given her the option of coming back to him. He's planning to build them a house, and they'll continue their life together if she can just live with the fact that he was engineering her father's demise. If there hadn't been the, you know, onset of television and new dancing opportunities that were opening up on TV shows, every variety. It was like vaudeville moved to TV in the 50s. If she hadn't had a chance to go there and maybe remake her life with the limited skills that she had, no education and no skills other than dancing, I'm not sure what my character would have done. I don't think she was going to have a Me Too moment at all, utterly powerless, but she decides to drive east instead and possibly find the father's family, the family that her family had left behind. She had, you know, no one in the world. So I think in order to have a Me Too moment, you've got to have solidarity around you. Mm-hmm. And Esme was entirely alone in the Las Vegas wash, her father's car, empty, dark, and open. She knows he's been carried off somewhere. They'll never find the body. And what does she have except for this man who's betrayed him and will probably one day betray her? So she makes a different choice.
Well, for me, even though it's a historical novel, in a way, we sometimes use history to present the present. So in a way, there's some things about the novel that are ahistorical. And especially, like, I have a group of chorus girls, and at the time, the idea of a chorus girl was that you could replicate the perfect woman. So Rose gets together, and I was sort of influenced by the writing of Jean Reese, who wrote Wild Sargasso Sea, and I was interested in her biography because she had been a chorus girl, and I always thought that was interesting because she's like the most miserable, depressive, melancholic writer, and how could she have been a chorus girl? And then I found, you know, one of the reasons she was kicked out of the chorus line was because she like wasn't refusing to smile and just looking miserable on stage, and they're like, you're beautiful, but just can you put a little pep in it? And she's like, the world sucks, I can't. So I was really kind of inspired that so all the chorus girls that Rose gets together are the most like misfit, like uncoordinated, like girls from the street, and then they have these conversations together, which at the time wouldn't have been possible, some of the conversations, because mm-hmm. what feminism has done for us is allowed us the language to articulate certain situations that women are in, whereas during the Depression, women were facing these situations, but they didn't have the language to communicate it with each other. So these chorus girls, sometimes they have conversations about what it is to be a woman, and it's as though they've just been reading like Germaine Greer or Judith Butler, which is just impossible. So in a lot of ways, and Rose became sort of more articulate about feminism than I myself was, and I learned a lot from her as a character, and I was surprised how enraged she was, and I learned through her, like, she kind of brought out this inner strength in myself, and she was able to articulate things that I hadn't been unable to. And a few months ago, I also came out with the Me Too movement. There was some sexual abuse that was happening at a university in Montreal, and I wrote a tweet about it, and I was like, I can't tweet this. And my daughter was like, do it, Mom. And I was like, oh, it's going to cause so much shit. But she was like, do it, do it, do it. So I tweeted it, and within an hour, there was like 3 news cameras at the door. But because that's what the Me Too movement is, incredibly powerful right now, and to tweet Me Too and have an actual, it just has an effect, whereas that tweet would have just gone unnoticed 5 years ago. But I feel like actually through writing this novel, it gave me the strength to be able to do things like that.
Yeah, incredible story. Well, I'd love to ask, you know, if the audience has any questions. I mean, we can keep going up here, but I think it's your turn. And so, yeah, hi. I think there's a microphone, so he'll come running over. And she's over there.
Oops. Hi. This is for Heather. Mm-hmm. I'm just so excited to see you. I just read a couple of your novels, and I'm so inspired. One of the things is I'm in recovery, and so all your topics on addiction have just really been helpful.
Oh, thank you.
So that's one thing. And I was curious, since we're talking about historical fiction, if when you write your novels, if history kind of guides your plot, or if you just kind of you plan it before, or how that works in your story writing.
It kind of goes a bit hand in hand. Like it offered opportunities. Like there's a scene when, because Montreal was a real mecca for crime at the time, because they didn't have prohibition for one thing. So all the Americans would come up, and Al Capone, and they used it as a trade route for alcohol, and also all the American soldiers, before they were shipped out overseas to war, would be stationed in Montreal. So the brothels were prolific everywhere. And the mafia ran the city. Like, it was an open city. Anything went, and nobody could clean it up. And actually the only time Montreal finally got cleaned up was the American government contacted the city, and they said, listen, you have to do something about your city, because the entire American army has the clap. And we're going to stop porting them there. And, like, we couldn't lose the money from the sailors, so they finally cleaned up the red light district a bit. So there's just different things. Like, when Rose and Piero go to New York to make that connection with the moon and the heroin, it was exactly at the same time that the Montreal and the Italian mafia in Montreal made a connection, and it became the French Connection of heroin going through, and it created a sixth family of the mafia in Montreal. So they're actually, everything they're doing is sort of following these historical movements in Montreal, but in the most sort of strange telling of it. But it's kind of funny, because a lot of times when you write, you think something is totally crazy, but then then you look it up, and you're like, it's all in the back of your head, and you're like, oh, that actually, I must have read that someplace when I was 14, and it came back to me. So they kind of go hand in hand, and they do, like, historical stuff can totally help by giving you a little structure.
Can you give to that lady in the front?
Okay, I loved the idea that your character taught you something, Heather, and I'd love to hear what the experience for the other two authors was in writing their books, if it gave you something it gave you.
Go.
Well, I didn't know Las Vegas was built by Jewish mobsters. I always thought it was Italian-American mobsters who built it. My knowledge of it was just based on, you know, the Godfather Casino or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I was really surprised to see how many Midwestern Jewish mobsters moved into Las Vegas after Prohibition and set up all the casinos and the hotels, and they were entertainment directors, and I also don't think I understood at the time that the purpose of the casinos was to launder money. The drug money, Meyer Lansky's big drug networks, were all this money was run through the casinos and then run out again. So that was surprising to me, and I found it hilarious that, say, Jack Entratter, one of the entertainment directors at the hotel, was president of the new synagogue that the Jewish people had built there, and that the whole thing was a big mesh, and that they then began to make money by building Las Vegas, and they built the first suburban housing tract just on the side of the strip, and they built office buildings and condos and libraries and contributed to UNLV and built, you know, the mall. So they were empire builders in the same way the old vaudeville, now we're going to do talkie pictures, took over Hollywood, and the Jews built an empire of Hollywood. Well, there was a second, you know, Jewish empire that I hadn't even known about, sort of in the shadow of Hollywood, despite all its big neon lights. But that's what I learned.
I have to say, I'm trying to think about what I learned. I think the thing that we all learn, maybe I'm romanticizing, I think we learn to love our bad guys and our bad gals. I mean, I think that's our job, is that we have to completely inhabit each of the characters to the extent that even the man who is staying behind, letting his family go off to the West while he searches for his beloved slave who's been sold. You know, you have to be able to love him or you can't write about him. That's the way I think. And then the other thing for me was that I had to figure out what Martin, the 13-year-old boy, whose pet was Cuff the Bear. And I had to really think about, fortunately I have a 13-year-old grandson, so I was able to think about him quite a bit. And he's not a vicious kid, he's pretty gentle. But all of that male, well, not even male, just all of that social prescription would have been, you know, you get rid of the bear. The bear's not coming. That's what his father said. The bear's not going. Yeah. And along the way, as the bear causes trouble, of course the bear, you know. So I really, for about a year and a half, wrestled with it. I wrote different things. I thought, well, were I Faulkner, of course, you know, the bear would be a rug very soon. And, you know, were I Galway Canal, the bear would be eating glass and dribbling blood all over the, you know, I mean, horrible things happen to bears in our country, and bears are a big part of us. So I think for me it was learning how I could surmount those messages from the past and still make it believable enough that you believed it. I think that was my big issue, yeah.
Thanks. Here's
one. This is for all three of you. I wanted to ask, how much of your research do you do before you start writing?
I think I always start with character and story, and then the minute I start moving them through the world, I realize I don't know what that world looks like. And so that's when I'll begin the research. And we're lucky now with all these online sites. So I can go to USC and UNLV, and they have archives, and they have photographs of every neighborhood through every decade. So I could actually see what the places look like. But I think there's also that danger of trying to cram everything that you saw and that you now know into the book until the book becomes just almost like a storage unit of artifacts, and then it begins to interfere with what people are reading for, which is they're reading to see characters move through time and space and interact with each other. And so some of my early drafts would be a little chock full of stuff, and I remember my opening scene has Esme visiting the new flamingo site with her dad and Ben Siegel, and Ben tells her, like, here's where your stage is going to be, and why don't you dance for me, and she does this whole cowgirl number, and he's not happy because his vision of Vegas is Hollywood out in the desert, not the cowboys that were out in the desert. And I had this whole riff about the, you know, auctioning off of plats of land and how they had to cool down the auction tent with blocks of ice, and I'd given it to my daughter to read, and she said, well, Mom, it felt a little overloaded, like when I got to that part about the blocks of ice, and my husband from the other room calls out, hey, I told you to take out those blocks of ice.
Did you actually live in Las Vegas for a while to get a sense of it, or did you?
I didn't live there, but my husband and I were students in the late 80s, and it was not quite the old Las Vegas then, but not quite what it's become, and you could still get a hotel room for, like, you know, $35, and you could eat a steak dinner for $1.99. And so for students with no money, it was a great vacation for us. We could drive out there. That's gone. When you go to Vegas now, you'll pay the same price as you pay in any city to live and eat. But we would just have a blast, you know, going from casino to casino, all of which are gone now, and all the beautiful, gaudy neon is sitting what they call the Boneyard now, the outdoor area of the Neon Museum. So you just have to walk and look and imagine how kitschy and tacky and fun it was. A lot of that was still left when we were there.
Cool. Linda, I know you had a cotton challenge in your research. Was that in this book or was that in The Purchase?
I think it was in The Purchase. Yeah. I had everyone farming cotton, and then I, at some late stage, learned that in southwestern Virginia, there was no cotton. That was really bad. And some of my, you know, the thing is, you fall in love with some of your scenes. You know, I really love that sentence. Mm-hmm. I can't get rid of that. So some of the sentences around cotton, I just wasn't willing. I mean, I suppose I could have planted peanuts, or I don't know what I would plant. But then I had the lucky break of finding out that at a certain point, someone discovered uphill cotton. It wasn't quite as nice. It wasn't as nice as the coastal version. And also, this is interesting. Here's one of those historical facts that you're really glad you found out. When Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin, and you might think, oh, well, now we don't need slaves anymore, right? No, we had 40 times more slaves because the gin was able to produce cotton so quickly that they had to have more and more cotton. So, in fact, it was the death knell for saving the slaves. It made it all go on longer. And it was stuff like that.
Yeah.
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 It kind of goes, yeah, it goes hand in hand. Like, at one point, I was sort of stuck with the novel and how I wanted to write it, and then I saw this map of the red light district that a criminal had made in the 1930s, and it showed all the secret passages, like how if a brothel was raided, you could go down the alley and knock on a gambling door, and they would let you through and go up to the second floor apartment. You could go down some stairs, and it was just all like this intricate set, and it reminded me of a theatrical set. So then I had the idea, like, oh, I'll write the whole novel as though it's a theatrical production. And it'll be like a commedia dell'arte, like the Italian form of Renaissance theater for clowns. And then I thought it was brilliant. And then so with my daughter and I, we decided, I was like, every clown show that comes through Montreal, let's go see it. And it was just like a challenge, too. So then actually there was this one advertisement we saw for a clown that was coming from Paris, and he played a violin that was this small. And we were like, oh my God, we have to see this clown, because by this point we were just like obsessed. And you sort of figure everyone else is obsessed with whatever you're obsessed with. So we put like a cross on the calendar for the Saturday morning when the tickets went on sale at 10 a.m. And then we woke up on Saturday morning, it was like 1 p.m. because we both sleep in and we're like, what's the matter with you? And we're just like yelling at each other and all flustered, and we're like, the tickets. And then I was like, well, we can't call because they'll put us on hold and then we'll miss all the tickets. And then we're like, we'll have to go down to the theater itself. And it was like pouring rain outside, so we put on all our clothes and we like ran all the way down. It was like a 20-minute run. We got to like this little theater where it was being put on at Théâtre Saint-Denis. And I got to the ticket counter, like soaking wet out of breath, and I was like, excuse me, sir. And it was like a young guy working there. I'm like, what tickets for the clown show are left? And he looks at me, he's like, dude, all of them.
However, I think this book will bring back an ardor for clown shows. So, we have one more question. Yeah.
Hi there. This is for everyone. If you just talk about any other historical fiction writers who have either inspired you or that you'd recommend. Mm.
Hmm. What's a historical fiction writer?
Yeah.
I've never been sure.
I wish I could help you. I'm moderating the panel, and I don't really know. I think it's like set in a setting that predates your life. I will say that. So even though I may write around about the 60s at times, that's not historical.
But so if I read Thomas Hardy, then I have to know when he was he writing before his life, or I don't pay attention. I mean, I just know that I like books that take place in the past, but maybe they were written by somebody who lived then.
They were contemporary at the time.
They're historical to me. Yeah. Yeah. So oh dear.
Yeah.
I always pick up Sarah Waters. I just love her stuff.
Yeah, she's...
Yeah, and when Allie Smith wrote, which was what, how, I don't know, I read everything by Allie Smith, but she wrote this wonderful one set in the past. How to Be Both was wonderful, and... Oh, sorry, it's great. Hilary Mantel, of course.
Hilary Mantel, yeah.
Seems redundant to say.
Do you have any?
I'm a big history buff, and so I just read lots of nonfiction, right now I'm reading Prairie Fires, the bio of Laura Ingalls Wilder, which is really making me understand what the pioneer movement West was like and how utterly bleak it was, and also just read a lot of Vietnam fiction. I'm going to be working on a new book set in the 70s, even though you say the 60s are not historical. They really are becoming historical now, with all the artifacts and fashion.
And sometimes it can be fun when writers do historical fiction that's not historically accurate, like Patrick DeWitt's Sisters Brothers, which took like a Western, and it was just like so not a Western that it becomes hilarious.
And I know, Adrian, that you mentioned this, is that you had to compress a lot, you know, for the purpose of the arc of the story. So it's kind of a trap to be historically accurate if you're trying to tell a tale, but you want to capture the time. And some things are sort of non-negotiable, such as the Civil War or the, you know, Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. These are such big drivers. Okay, I think do we have time for one more question? I know that some of the writers need to be elsewhere, so. Okay, well, good. Are you? And I think there was somebody back farther. So.
You actually touched a little bit on this. I was wondering, when you're writing historical fiction, where's the fine line, or because it's fiction, there isn't a fine line of where our social views are of what the past was versus what it really was and what was happening to the people. How do you find the line of not putting your views into it?
That's really good.
To what is really happening?
Brilliant question. I think you have to, what I do is I read a lot from the period. Diaries, for example. I read slave narratives. I read plantation diaries. I read, and it's upsetting. It's upsetting, and you want to fix them. You want to have them be better than they were, or worse than they were sometimes. And we forget that sort of everyone believed in God. Mm-hmm. They had different perspectives on who God was and what God was supposed to be doing for you, but they did believe almost to a nanosecond. So there was a kind of more unified culture in that way. So you have to kind of swallow that. You have to say, okay, if I'm doing this, I have to go there. I have to be able to understand mm-hmm. that. I have to be able to understand why a woman didn't show her ankle mm-hmm. And how it would have been perceived if she had, and that you wouldn't use the word leg. You know, that was like saying something, you know. So all that stuff, you just have to kind of get it embedded in your brain so that it becomes natural, I think.
I think for me, the most painful scene in the novel is right after the mom's abortion, when she basically hemorrhages to death. And I had read a news story about a young woman who had a little boy and had an abortion, and her mom had picked her up, and she was in the back seat of the car holding her child and just quietly bled to death. And I just wanted to demonstrate, I guess, how these illegal abortions affected these women. Ben Siegel ran a lot of brothels, and so he needed a lot of abortion parlors. And so the mom and Esme go to the movies, which in that day was an all-day activity. You saw newsreels, you saw shorts, you saw cartoons, you saw one movie and then another. And the whole time that the mother is there, she's slowly bleeding to death. And her daughter doesn't realize it until halfway through, and then decides, I know my mom's dead, but I'm just going to snuggle up with her one last time until the end of the movie. And only realizes later, as an adult, if I'd said something, maybe I could have saved her.
I think it's all imagined, because, I mean, all the artifacts and accounts of history are written by the elite and by certain groups of people. So there's just so much that we don't know. And there, like, even to find, it was really difficult to even find historical artifacts of how women were living in Montreal in the 1930s, because they had no voices, they weren't writing, and a lot of stuff in history is just oppressed. Like, I went to the nuns had a museum, and because at the beginning of the novel, the women are kept unwed mothers are entering this place called the Hôpital de Misericorde. And I asked them, like, I know the girls were given pseudonyms. Can I have a list of the pseudonyms that the girls were given? And they were very hesitant to give it to me. And I was like, well, it's like, you kind of have to give it to me. It's like public knowledge. And she was like, well, let me just tell you before I give this to you that sometimes when someone sees a text and they're looking for something, they're going to find what they're already looking for in that. And I was like, I know, I'm a writer. Can I see the list, please? And she was like, listen, I'll tell you again. When one is a radical feminist, one has a certain perspective they see everywhere. And I was like, what makes you think I'm a radical feminist? And she was like, oh, come on. So anyway, she gave me the list of pseudonyms. And she said, they were completely given randomly, like the names of hurricanes. It was A, B, C, whatever. And I read them, and they were names like Humiliation Anna and Dismal and Salome, and they were just all pejorative names. And then I asked for some other records, and she was like, oh, well, those have all been were destroyed in the war. And I was like, destroyed in the war? It's like, this is Canada. There was no fighting. Like, we fought overseas. How can something be destroyed in the war? But just to say, like, so much of history is unknown to us, so we are working in the realms. Yeah. For me, it's always, it's almost like within the realm of fairy tale, what people were thinking, because so we don't know. We just have access to generally very wealthy white men in their respective times.
I'll just add the most fun for me is I have a mix of historical and fictional characters, and to get the two to dovetail, to have an actual historical event take place where my character can be part of it, makes it a lot of fun for me. Mm-hmm. So Tony Cornero was famously killed early morning hours with poisoned drink in a casino at the Desert Inn. It was served, the drink was served by a cocktail waitress. So how fun was it to have my character be the one who serves him the drink and have him drop dead at her feet? Things like that.
Spoiler alert.
In Canada, we have a famous abolitionist named Alexander Ross, who did go down into the South and did talk to plantation owners and say, I'm an ornithologist, may I go out in your fields and study your birds? And meanwhile, he would go out and study the slaves and say, here's a compass, here's a map, here's some direction, blah, blah, blah. So he, you know, he managed to direct a lot of people north. I don't think he directed any of the people in my family, but it certainly was convenient for me that I knew about this guy. And I needed an abolitionist and so forth. So yeah, we do that, right? We cheat a little bit.
Well, I'm afraid that's all we have time for. And I really want to thank all three of you. I feel like you've been in my life for the last month. You may not know it, but it's just been a pleasure to be in your company. I want to thank Heather O'Neill, Linda Spaulding, and Adrian Sharp. And also, this session was brought by the Consulate General of Canada in San Francisco and Silicon Valley. Please go out to the courtyard. All three of the authors will be happy to sign copies of their books. Get them.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.